Welcome, everyone. My name is Lisa Cardi. I'm the Deputy Director of the Global Health Policy Center here at CSIS. I'm very grateful to you all for coming to join us today, and particularly grateful that we have Michelle Sidibe with us, the Executive Director of UNAIDS. Before we get started, I'd like to make just a few brief announcements pertaining to some of our work here at CSIS. First, I think many of you are aware that we have a CSIS-sponsored Commission on Smart Global Health Policy that is underway this year. The purpose of the commission is by the end of the year to make some recommendations on a longer-term approach for U.S. investments in global health, really looking out over the period 2010 to 2015. As part of the commission initiative, we have a commission website. That website is www.smartglobalhealth.org, and it's actually an interactive website where we're inviting public comment on the commission's work. If you have a moment and can go to the website, you'll see that there is a description of the scope and the focus of what the commission is about, but also a place where we ask folks like yourselves who are committed and engaged and knowledgeable about the issues to tell us what you think. So we'd be very grateful, actually, if you had some time in the next several weeks to take a look at that website and share your thoughts with us. Secondly, our speaker series is continuing this fall. This is our first event of the fall with Michelle, but in about 2 weeks we'll have Julie Gerberding with us, the former director of CDC. She'll be with us on September 23rd at 3 in the afternoon, and she'll be reflecting on her tenure as CDC director, so we hope that many of you can join us for that. We also have an event on Capitol Hill this Wednesday morning at 9 a.m., co-hosted with the Congressional Global Health Caucus. The focus of that is looking at the new university activism around global health, and there are some flyers out the back door that have more details on that event. So, today we are enormously lucky to have with us Michelle Sidibe, the Executive Director of UNAIDS, who's here in Washington at a very interesting moment when the U.S. domestic healthcare debate is front and center, literally on the front page of our newspapers every morning, and is consuming enormous amounts of time and energy, as it should. However, at the same time, the stakes could not be higher for the future of U.S. global health policy, in particular for the response to HIV, both as the U.S. government develops its approaches under PEPFAR 2 and as other donors in countries affected by AIDS grapple with the impact of the global economic crisis on their ability to deliver essential services. Michelle comes to his current position with impressive credentials to meet these challenges. Before joining UNAIDS, he spent more than 25 years in public service. He began his career in global health and development in his native Mali as country director for Terre des Hommes. In 1987, he joined UNICEF, and in his 14 years there, oversaw programs across 10 Francophone countries, including serving as UNICEF country representative in Swaziland, Burundi, and Uganda. He became director of country and regional support for UNAIDS in 2001 and was appointed deputy executive director in 2007 and executive director this past January. Now, that's Michelle's official biographical statement. But I am very fortunate that I can add a personal comment or two here, as I had the great good fortune in the 2 years before I came to work at CSIS, of working for UNAIDS in Moscow, Russia, where Michelle was my big boss. So what Michelle's official bio does not adequately capture is that he is a person of deep conviction, tremendous vision, and abiding optimism. Michelle will not take credit, but he deserves full credit for being the architect and driving force behind the universal access movement for HIV prevention, treatment, care, and support. I know this to be true because I was on the receiving end of many directives from Michelle urging us in the field to get with it, and quite rightfully so, impressing upon us the real urgency of the task at hand. I can say from personal experience that Michelle truly leads by example, not only through his words, but more importantly, through his actions. He's playing a pivotal role in driving the AIDS response forward. Michelle, it's really a great pleasure to have you here with us this morning.
Thank you very much, Lisa. I'm very touched by your very, very can say, personal words, which are just making me feel embarrassed. But
welcome.
Thank you very much. Dear friends and colleagues, it is a privilege to deliver my first speech in Washington amongst colleagues here at the Centers for Strategic and International Studies. I would like to thank my Washington teams. Sometimes we forgot to do that. They're working so hard to make those type of meeting possible for us, for setting up this visit in Washington. I'm thinking about John Assel, I don't know if he's here, Greg Smile, and Pauline Mushina. The center has a long story of inspiring and informing policies on the management on transnational challenges. Today, I will address one such challenge, AIDS, framing it as an opportunity. In much the same way the Secretary of State, Clinton, views a global health policy as a signature element of American soft power, I view the AIDS response as a signature element of the global transformation of development thinking. I want to thank you, Lisa, and Steve Morrison, for maintaining the space for AIDS at the center and for organizing this dialogue, this conversation today with you. I have been following your commission on a smart global health policy and look forward to engaging with the finding of the commissioners. I am honored and moved to see many friends and leading AIDS fighters in this room. I feel very much at home. You have made it your business to keep AIDS high on the U.S. agenda. On the world agenda, you inspire me. Friends, before we talk of the future of the AIDS response, let us reflect on the past, beginning with a tribute to a friend to many of us in this room, Senator Ted Kennedy. In everything he did, he always cared for the least of these. He personally intervened in the reauthorization of PEPFAR and the lifting the HIV travel ban. We are indebted to his memory, and we must meet the challenge of his legacy to soldiers on in the fight against AIDS. In this fight, we stand on the shoulder of giants. People like Roger McFarlane, a leader in the gay rights movement during the early days of the AIDS epidemic, and the first executive director of Gay Men's Health Crisis in New York, who passed away earlier this year. The AIDS movement in America has produced so many world changers like Roger McFarlane and changed the world they have. Together, we have shattered the conspiracy of silence surrounding AIDS, replacing it with a deafening demand for universal access to HIV prevention, treatment, care, and support. HIV prevention, care, and support universal access are not just about number. We are not just talking about making sure that we will have 100% coverage everywhere. We know that it will not be even possible in America. But what we are talking about when we are talking about universal access, we are talking about social justice. We are talking about redistribution of opportunity. We are talking about reaching and reachable. We are talking about making sure at least we can give a voice to the voiceless. What we are talking about when we are talking about universal access is to rethink the way we do business, making sure that with less money, we can reach more people by revisiting our delivery system, reinventing how we work with the communities. That is really about dealing with the core issues of universal access. And that's why I'm happy that you are mentioning universal access, because it's just on the corner. We can say that a few months from now, the world will ask us what we have been able to do. And it's important for us to review progress, to make sure that we push our leaders to respond to the demand of the people. I am happy to know that we didn't not only break this conspiracy of silence, funders also responded. Financing for HIV leaped from $300 million in 1996 to almost $14 billion last year. Service providers responded. Millions of infections have been averted. For most of the world, treatment access was almost non-existent in 2000. Today, there are 4 million people with HIV who are alive because they have access to life-saving treatment. Countless communities responded, stamping out stigma and discrimination, confronting social norms which drive vulnerability to HIV, and devising creative ways to respond to the needs of those infected and affected by HIV, and all too often at considerable personal risk. In short, people like you have changed our world because you choose to do so. And that is very important. I am convinced that this fight against HIV/AIDS is not just effective because we are talking about what we have been doing in terms of reducing number of new infections. But it is effective because we have been able, really, to mobilize these constituencies. And let us remind ourselves, AIDS is the only disease with those constituencies, those activism, with people fighting to make sure that at least we don't forget the face of people who are suffering, and make sure that we change laws, request our leaders to respond to the demand of those millions of people we will never have chance to meet. And that is important. That is why I'm happy to be in this room with you, because you choose to do so. And because you did that, we are making a difference together. Yet, let us be frank also. Despite these heroic efforts, HIV continues to outstrip our response. Over 7 million people living with HIV who desperately need life-saving treatment go without it today. I'm just saying 7 million people who are in need to have those life-saving treatment go without it. Friends and colleagues, it is unacceptable that for every 2 people newly on treatment, another 5 are infected. In other words, 2.5 million new infections could have been averted last year, but were not. Our ambition is to produce a generation of young people that is informed and empowered to protect themselves from HIV infection. Yet, in countries across throughout the world, only a minority of young people know how to prevent sexual transmission of HIV. Here in the US, CDC reported that in a survey of 5 large cities, 25% of the men who have sex with men were living with HIV, and less than half of them were aware of their infection. While we should be focusing our efforts on population at a higher risk of HIV, such as men who have sex with men, injecting drug users, and sex workers and their clients, we continue to fail these people in all corners of the world. Worldwide, less than half of the injecting drug users are reached by information or needle exchange programs. I need not remind you that this virus ravaged the African-American communities right here in Washington, D.C., the capital of the world's wealthiest countries. HIV prevalence among African-American in the districts is higher than in 28 African countries. Beyond these uncomfortable statistics are human lives. Lives changed by sickness, by suffering and shame, by joblessness and poverty, by the side effects of drugs, by the loss of a mother or friend. Friends, let us not forget the human dimensions of our collective failures. Let us not forget why we are here. I won't focus on the reason of our collective failures. They are well documented. We systematically underinvest in prevention. We often invest in ineffective intervention, fail to make optimum use of the funds or take advantage of opportunities. All too often, punitive laws undermine our efforts, as do the persistence is a stigma and discrimination. And structural causes such as poverty and inequality fuel the pandemic. We need to acknowledge and address these causes and learn from and rectify the mistakes we have made in the past. We can do this. Change is possible, but only if we are ready to address the underlying drivers of the epidemic. The world, as you know, is increasingly focused on issues such as climate change and terrorism, with good reason. But having traveled to all the forefronts of the epidemics this year, I can say that the other great global issues. But less explicit is inequity. The growing gap between the rich and the poor, and the increasing dissatisfaction in the world about accepting that gap. HIV has stayed in the forefront because it has highlighted in ugly and dramatic ways that the poor die when they get sick with AIDS, and the rich live. Last year, 2 million people died from HIV/AIDS. 1.7 million of them were from Africa. 1.9 million of them were from developing countries. Most of the people in the North are not dying anymore from HIV, from AIDS. That is the disparity, inequity we are talking about. When we are thinking about the recent economic crisis, we are just also underlining the growing divide between the super rich and the rest of the world. And it has made many very uneasy that we were willing to pump out hundreds of billions to save our banks, but not to feed or house the poor. This suggests that the global response to HIV and the work of UNAIDS have to reposition themselves as an essential connection between the virus and our effort to address inequalities and inequities. HIV prevention will not stop to spread of HIV unless inequalities between men and women, including those related to control over sexuality and control over economic opportunities, are also addressed. On the other side, infection from HIV and death by AIDS and the widespread stigma and discrimination that do not go away remain a bright markers of these inequalities. It is also increasingly clear that sustaining billions of dollars for HIV treatment will not succeed if inequalities between rich and poor countries are not also addressed. HIV also underscores the glaring lack of sustainability in the face of food and nutritional insecurity. Treatment will ultimately fail if people do not have enough to eat or cannot get to the clinic. So HIV is about and has to be about addressing social and human rights inequalities, larger than just the virus, gender inequality, income inequality, social inequalities, discrimination on various bases, food insecurity, physical insecurity. So HIV is about three things: health, dignity, and security. In 2009, we are still largely stuck on health alone at all levels. I would like to acknowledge of the leadership of the Obama administration, and in particular the new comprehensive global health strategy, which represents a remarkable advance on many fronts. I want to talk about just one of those fronts today, an advance that carries the seeds of the transformation of the AIDS epidemic from emergency management to a sustained response. As the global health strategy points out, the struggle against AIDS, for all its uniqueness, cannot be left in a silo. AIDS will be best served by integrated approaches that strengthen public health systems accessible by all. Maternal and child health, reproductive and sexual health, effort to curb TB and other diseases. Their synergy with AIDS response are still largely untapped. Where AIDS programs are vertical and drain human and financial resources from broader public health services, we must take the response out of isolation and link it to the Millennium Development Goals. This is what I call the AIDS Plus MDG agenda. The AIDS Plus MDG agenda provides an opportunity to unite the creativity, determination, and momentum of the AIDS movement with the movement for other MDGs. Surely this will accelerate progress on AIDS as well as other MDG targets, reaping bidirectional benefit and multiplier effects. Consider the rapid scaling up of prevention of mother-to-child transmission intervention. PMTCT Plus provides an ideal platform from which to deliver services catering to maternal, child, and sexual and reproductive health and rights, including putting proper emphasis back on unintended pregnancies. Not to mention involving men in addressing gender norms and behaviors, as well as taking up a range of rights issues. Linking PMTCT with other MDG efforts allow us to integrate surveillance and monitoring system, to bundle logistics and procurement, and to address common challenges to all of these services, including human resources and incentives. One of my objectives in visiting Washington this week is to invite the U.S. administration to support a high-intensity fast-track campaign to eliminate mother-to-child transmission of HIV by 2015, making this a centerpiece of a new global health initiative. In the U.S. and Europe, the transmission from the mother to the child is approaching zero, while for lack of testing and treatment, 300,000 African babies are born with HIV each year. Tell me, can we right this wrong together? Common sense tells us we can have more impact in each MDG area and do more with less by integrating effort across the MDGs. The AIDS Plus MDG agenda also opens the space to reflect critically on different approaches to development and social justice. For its part, the AIDS response has been at the vanguard of community empowerment, inclusivity, human rights and gender sensitivity, and social protection that I mentioned earlier. Perhaps most importantly, the AIDS Plus MDG agenda means responding to people's needs for a holistic continuum of care as opposed to stovepipe services. But taking AIDS out of isolation is not the end of AIDS exceptionalism. AIDS is exceptional because, in the words of Bob Orr, of the UN Secretary General Office, it gets to the heart of a marginalized community and to sex. All these are things that will naturally fall in the shadows if we don't keep it exceptional. We must avoid at all costs in mainstreaming AIDS into invisibility. Integration must not become a Trojan horse for AIDS fatigue 30 years into the pandemic. And this is where UNAIDS fits. With a small staff, over 80 countries, we are on the front lines. Political brokering, community organizing, social mobilization, sharing strategic information, offering evidence-based policy recommendation, standing up for the marginalized and infected who are excluded from the corridors of powers and life-saving services. These are the hallmarks of our movement. UNAIDS urge and demand more action on all fronts of the AIDS battle. We have the science, the power of a civil society, and the stature of the UN system to make intervention that no other organization can match. But we cannot do this in isolation. The value proposition of UNAIDS, our ABCs, advocating, brokering, and convening, is now more urgent than it has ever been. Every day, I remain president and prime ministers, finance and health minister, heads of UN agencies of their commitments. AIDS is not a fad that has passed into history. In closing, I am in the U.S. at an exciting time, like Lisa, you said. A time of change and a renewal. A time of willingness to confront old problems in new ways. We are witnessing a paradigm shift in the U.S. approach to the global pandemic, one which is widely welcomed and is winning the Obama administration much admiration and friends abroad. In this atmosphere of hope and goodwill, I see a window of opportunity which we cannot afford to miss. An opportunity to unite, a powerful bilateral vision with multilateral legitimacy, an opportunity to support national reform efforts to overturn punitive laws, to spend strategically, and to deliver real results on the ground. The prospect for universal access have never seemed so bright, even in these hard times. The violence look to us, and the world changers to realize this potential. Please, we must not let them down. Thank you for your time.
So thank you, Michelle, for a very illuminating overview of the direction you see both the epidemic going and UNAIDS' role in the response. We do have time for questions, and I'm assuming there are many out there. I think what we will try to do maybe is take questions in groups of three. And what I would ask you to do, please, is to please keep your question to a question, and please identify yourself before you pose your question. So the floor is open. And we have mics, and if you wouldn't mind just waiting for the mic, because we are recording the presentation today.
Yeah, hi, David Bryden. I'm with I'm with the I'm with the Infectious Disease Society of America, and I wanted to ask you in particular about your strategy in terms of approaching the Obama administration on the Global Health Initiative and this very exciting push that you talked about on prevention of mother-to-child transmission. One of the aspects of that I'd be interested to hear your comments on is whether it makes sense to provide to focus in on that population as a beginning with regard to earlier treatment at an earlier stage in the disease. And that's something that I think is important when we look at cost efficiencies, looking overall when it comes to tuberculosis and other situations. And I ask about these issues because as we look at the Obama administration, we've been very concerned at this abandonment of the commitments, the financing commitments incorporated in the Lantus-Hyde legislation and the impact that will have on Mali and other countries across Africa when we look at the Global Fund, when we look at PEPFAR itself. And so universal access, we think, is extremely important, and prevention of mother-to-child transmission is a great place to start. I'd be interested in your comments on that.
Further question? Please. Mm-hmm.
Leghorn Futures Group. Thank you for that very inspiring talk. I do want to ask the question that you mentioned, which is really about cost. And as you know, we're all in the situation of trying to assess what the current costs are to deliver not only treatment but prevention, and how some of the models that we are using really point in the direction of lack of resources. For example, if we succeeded in preventing mother-to-child transmission, you'd actually identify a large number of people that need treatment. How are we going to get there with the current level of commitments?
Michelle, why don't we take those?
Global Health Initiative. I think it's a very good question, and you did well to raise that one. For me, what is the beauty of this initiative is to help us certainly to see health as a foreign policy, and which is very important. Is in that case, it means also not seeing health anymore as a cost, but seeing health as an investment. Investment for changing the world, which is critical if you want really to make a big difference fighting disease out there. So the beauty of this whole effort is probably to move from, like I was just saying, an emergency type of approach and coming with a more long-term strategic approach which is sustainable and bringing the issues of ownership, making sure that this effort is not just a transfer of resources from the north to the south, which is very important. I will not say that is not, but is also a process which will be owned by partners down there. So by reinforcing their system, by making sure that the discussion is not done in isolation, is bringing the integration of a different aspect of system approach, which is capacity development, which is a lack of probably health system in different places, laboratory system. We can continue like that. For me, that is very important. The second aspect, you reply on it, early treatment is important. Whatever we can say is already started in many parts of the world, and so is the guidelines which is being developed by WHO and UNAIDS and different co-sponsors will come out soon. And it will create a major challenge, which is linked to what you are saying, because if you want to go for early treatment, it means that we'll have more people on treatment and in need of those treatment, and which means also the cost of treatment will be higher. And that is certainly very important to keep in our mind. Early treatment, without any doubt, we don't need to have two approaches. One approach is, again, like I was saying, for the north, and second approach is for the south. We need to have the same, but it's means that we need to do also business differently. We need to look at effectiveness of how we invest $1 today and how this $1 is producing the maximum of returns. That is very critical. When we look at the unit cost of producing, for example, protecting mother to transmit the disease to the child, it's just like that, from one place to another. So why we have those different unit costs, how we can maximize and reduce that, that is something. But I remain convinced that mother-to-child transmission, keeping the mother alive and making sure that we avoid a baby to become infected will be a very important starting point in terms of mobilizing and engaging people around a movement which will bring integration, like I was saying. Your question on cost is a very difficult one because it's against a dilemma we are all having. Like I said, always, if the politician, they have the political responsibility to certainly fix the market, to make sure that investment can come and order. But they have also a moral responsibility to not abandon those 4 million people who are on treatment today. Stopping that, and I am, and any place I am going, I am calling for fully funded global fund. We have a gap there. We have a deputy executive director of Global Fund in the room, so and she can talk about it more than I can. But I am advocating strongly for a fully funded Global Fund because I am convinced that if it's not happening, most of those programs who have been already started will stop. I am seeing stock out in South Africa where we will never feel that stock out could happen in different places. I was there in Free State place. We are staying a risk in Rwanda, risk in Kenya, risk in Uganda. So that is something we need to continue to be aware by saying that, of course, we cannot continue without having, and you're well placed coming from where you're coming, we need to propose a models which could help us to look at a little bit through some kind of cost benchmark analysis, having a different scenarios of funding the treatment programs. But we cannot stop those programs. And we cannot feel that it will be possible. And we will have a major resistance. We will have those people will start dying after 6 months stopping their treatment. So you have a moral call here, a moral challenge, like I was saying, which is the challenge of our 21st century, the challenge of inequity, the challenge of inequality. So we need to deal with it. But at the same time, like I shared to the world, we have a huge gap if we want to really move towards achieving those goals. We need to continue to be a little bit more smart in terms of mobilizing resources, not just the classic channels. We need to think about different channels. We need to look at also how we engage more our respective country partners to have a long-term view in terms of the taking their people, their own people, on programs which will not be for 3 years, but 20 years, 30 years. So we need to look at what means budgeting also for social services on those places. And like I was saying, the biggest problem is that most of our ministers of finance considers investing in social services and particularly in health as a cost. It is not really an investment for them. So how we make the shift on those type of thinking and help them to understand that is, like I was saying, the soft power, which is so important for stabilizing. But I agree with you, is critical issues, and we need to come out with clear scenarios on the long term, what that means.
Sir.
Thank you. My name is Ahmed Mir. I'm retired from the U.S. Foreign Service and held a lot of positions dealing with science and WHO. The question I have, I'm not an expert in this area, is whether UNAIDS is participating broadly in other activities, international activities, health activities, because I think the impression I get is a focus on AIDS and focus on that issue. But I, as you were just saying, and hence my question, that I think you should have presence in other international bodies. You should have presence in trying to develop, for example, medical capacity in the developing world and in Africa. You should be involved in basic research and those institutions. Maybe there's basic research even dealing with medical issues in IAEA as an extreme case. But I think only that way you will be able to see and capture other resources of other agencies and other countries. I that's the question.
Let's do up in the front here. Seth, please.
Samuel Adeni Jones, HHS. You acknowledge President Obama's shift towards sustainability and country ownership. Mm-hmm. You and I were just at the WHO Africa Regional Ministers Conference. Mm-hmm. There's a big gap between the understanding of country ownership from the minister's point of view, mm-hmm. the health official in Africa, and donors' point of view. Mm-hmm. This is an area where UNAIDS can play a big role. How do you see the UNAIDS trying to help bridge this gap? I mean, it's a significant gap, and I think some work in bridging it might and help in actually in implementation.
Thank you. Please, right here.
My name is Kim, and I'm a student over at American University. And on a slightly different note from the other questions, I was wondering what you thought the role of individuals, especially of young people, could be in helping to achieve a lot of the goals that you spoke of.
Thank you very much. I will start with the last one because it's so important. We have almost 80% of new infection or through sexual transmission, and more than 40% are occurring amongst young people. And I think one major shift which we need to do is to really be able to develop programs which will not consider young people not only as passive beneficiaries of projects or programs or information, but making them actor of change. And that is central to whatever we are trying to do now in developing the support through our co-sponsors who can help to create a new leadership, mentorship of young people, and making sure that they are equipped with necessary information to help them to take appropriate decision, but participating to also a transformation of the society. And that is, for us, critical, using a new network, new tools, media network and tools to really make that happening. And roles of young people are critical, not only in as an advocate, not only, but also part of the research. We are seeing today most of our competent young people are staying abroad. So how to also attract, how to make sure that we have a new continental vision from different parts where the young people could be coming back and participating to the transformation by proposing new research, like Ahmad just mentioned, agenda for those developing countries are critical. So I'm saying that. The second point I want to address, Israeli country and financial law. You are so right, because the major debate today is that people are talking about more financial ownership, financial sustainability, when this shift is talking about country ownership, by linking data to better understanding of your epidemic or understanding of your situation, link that to what World Bank is doing with us by helping countries to develop their plan, strategic plan based on prioritization, which is really close to their own needs, and translated that into policies and programs and strategies which can be implemented. And for us, that is the true ownership. And that will link to sustainability of programs. But thinking that all the debate should be around financial ownership or finance, that will not happen tomorrow morning. We need, so that's the effort UN is with a co-sponsor we are trying to do now, to really equip the countries to have well-costed, evidence-based, prioritized a plan which could help them to better invest the resources they are receiving to respond to the pandemic. So I think, but you're right, still, even in Rwanda, the debate was crystallized around, but if it's that, how we can really progress if we don't have money. So I think it is time to also bring the debate around owning your own system, your own processes, and leading a new dialogue between bilaterals and multilaterals, and making sure that this response at the country levels can be responding to the needs of nationals. And so I think that's, for me, very important. I made a question on how UNAIDS can be. Is true, but what you're saying. But sometimes UNAIDS is perceived only as a secretariat. What I want to say, we are really helping to coordinate 10 co-sponsors. So through those, the work of those 10 co-sponsors, I was mentioning World Bank, UNFPA, WHO, all the different, we are working together to make sure that those aspects are addressed. You're right that during the last few years, we have been losing completely the focus on research, preventive research, pushing those agenda, and particularly I will say that bringing back the debate around cure, which are very important vaccines, disappearing completely from agenda, is like if we are just taken hostage, and that's what I was saying to First Lady of Rwanda, and we are taken hostage by treatment, molecular first line, second line, and that deletes completely our effort to really push the debate on cure and vaccine. And that is important to bring that back on the agenda, because I don't think so any of those countries will be able to cope with just the increased need of treatment and the cost, like you were just mentioning. So I think it's important to bring that. We have some hope with those antibodies which have been just, we'll see what it will give us, but it's important to mention that.
I'm going to take advantage of the chair's prerogative, Michelle, and pose my own question, which is the universal access agenda was originally framed around a 2010 set of targets, and 2010 now really is right around the corner. But you talked about some very fundamental problems that the AIDS response has been struggling with now for a number of years, the societal structural issues, the technical capacity issues, and there are several others. My question is, as you look down the road to 2010, which now is, less than 18 months away, what is the political strategy and what's the programmatic strategy for managing probably not reaching universal access in many places? And what do you see as the sort of the future beyond universal access in 2010? How does one push out that set of objectives? And what's the U.S. role in helping to do that?
Thank you very much. I think first things we will start reviewing all the progress region by region, looking what was happening since 2006 and document those progress, showing the gaps and making sure that country by country and region by region, we will lead this process like we led the process of formulating this setting of goals for universal access. We will do that one, and we'll come with a report which will help the countries also and region to take stock of the gaps. We are seeing many countries will achieve many aspects of universal access. Some of them and many of them also will not be able. But what is important is to create a new political momentum where AIDS could be linked to 2015. That's why I was talking about AIDS plus MDG, because I don't think so it will be politically correct to just say that, okay, 2010 is here, universal access is not possible, we didn't reach. No, I think it is a real momentum is there to link that to 2015, to recreate a new energy and remobilize the world around a few goals and set those targets and make sure that those targets become a new, way to produce results for people. And that is possible. And that's, for example, I was with a co-sponsor. We came with a result framework. For the first time, we have a result framework. And few of them are so important. If I'm taking the fact that saving mothers, saving babies, making sure that we could be able to keep a mother alive, it's so possible. It's happening in different parts of the world. And if we can really start with a generation free of AIDS by stopping those 300,000 babies being born with HIV, it's possible. It is a movement which can create a lot of enthusiasm, and people can come into and demonstrate that together we can deliver on that. That is so important. Let us not forget that each of those kids, after just if they don't have access to treatment, 30% will die before reaching their first years of anniversary. 50% will die before reaching the second year. So it's so costly for the society. And the remain will have to be on treatment for how long? So why not to fight for that? Secondly, I don't accept, and because I am a dreamer, probably an enthusiastic and passionate, but I don't think so is acceptable to have 500,000 people dying from co-infection. If the virus and bacteria can work together to kill people, why we cannot integrate and organize our effort to make sure that we stop those 500,000 people dying? We have all the drugs, we have the knowledge, we have the know-how. Why is not happening? We need to make that happening and make sure that that is why not to not have a conducive laws and which could help us to make universal access available for drug users? It's happening in different places. We are seeing today in many parts of the world drug users who are not anymore infected by HIV. So we can make sure that no drug user being infected by HIV. And it's possible. It's happening in Switzerland. It's happening in Netherlands. It's happening in different places. We have been seeing a huge progress happening in Indonesia, where we were not even able to talk about that. People were hiding themselves. If you had the chance to visit Jakarta on the rail station and shooting themselves. Today they are coming. You're even having a goal of 70% coverage before on armor. So I think it's possible, but why not to remove punitive laws? Why not? Why we have 80 countries today with criminal laws on homosexuals? I can understand people could have different view about homosexualities. But I cannot understand that because you have a different sexual orientation that you are criminal and that you have to go to jail. For that reason, many of us would have been already in jail for different other reasons, which are probably worse. So I personally feel those are things we can help to do and which could change completely the nature of our action. And that's part of the beauty of universal access and linking that to broader global agenda like AIDS plus MDG.
Thank you. I think we have time probably for one more quick round of questions. So please. And put your hands up high if you.
Hello, I'm Lindsay Stewart from USAID. I want to thank you so much for such an inspiring talk.
Thanks.
And I know you've been giving inspiring talks throughout the world because I see some of the press notes on it. And I just wanted to say I work in Latin America and the Caribbean, where in some places there are still very punitive laws.
Yes.
And I just want to encourage you to keep speaking out on to try to change those laws and to look at things from a public health point of view rather than a moral or judgmental way. My question to you is, have you seen any results in changing any of these punitive laws?
Thanks. And the woman in the back was in the pink shirt here.
My name is Leanne Evanson. I'm with the International HIV AIDS Alliance. I wanted to ask what your message might be, your complimentary message might be around to the Obama administration around concentrated epidemics, because using PMTCT as the entry point for integrating through the Global Health Initiative seems very appropriate and strategic in generalized epidemics, but in concentrated epidemics, as you pointed out, issues of universal access and inequity are really fueling those contexts.
And one last question over here, please.
Thank you. Harvey Sloan with the Eurasian Medical Education Program. Thanks for that wonderful talk. We certainly haven't done a lot in the United States about prevention. We've got 56,000 new infections every year. And as you say, in Washington, D.C., we have 3% of all of our population. And we have great resources. I would like to ask you, what is the UNAIDS thoughts about prevention? Certainly, universal access to care is very important in reduction and elimination of mother-to-child transfer. It does look like microbicides are going to come on the scene as we had hoped, and I think of vaccines a way ago. And we try in public health education, which is not really that effective. What are your thoughts?
I mean, you were saying that.
That's a challenging last question. Thank you, Harvey.
I better start with the last one, so I will not have to. No. I think you're completely right, and is even difficult for us to understand sometimes what is happening, because let us not forget that in the U.S. you were having more than 100,000. It went down to 40, and now it is going over 66,000 new infection. Prevention is so difficult. Before just coming here, I was talking with Lisa. I said that I will talk about prevention everywhere. It will be like a laser on prevention. But it's not enough. We need, first off, from my point of view, to have a prevention diplomacy. We didn't work enough with our leaders to be able to articulate their message, to be able to speak about prevention as something important. We don't have a prevention diplomacy. We don't have real constituency built out there capable to really support this all prevention movement. We are talking about it, and we are not. Second things, I think, is important for us to be able to be courageous and talk about what could be the face of success in prevention and how we measure that. What is the we don't have a capacity today to really have measure the incidence. And it's very difficult for us to continue to make a huge progress with the prevention programs and convince people to continue to invest on prevention if we are not even able to come out with a good measurement instrument tools, which are not there out there. For me, is one of the priorities I will, as UNAIDS, push with our colleagues, with co-sponsor, to start thinking about that. Because I heard I'm not competent. I have competent people around me, but I'm not competent on that. But I can say that I don't understand that people are telling me it's not possible, it's too complicated, it's too expensive, but we have competent people. I want to be able to say, if it's not possible, if it's complicated, you will never convince any people who are having resources to invest on prevention. It will be just a talk show. So I think for me that is another. And third, I personally feel that is important for us to be courageous and have what I am trying to put in place, an oversight of a prevention global agenda with a competent, which could be linked to your task force and your commissioners on group, to look at what are the five or four things we can really do to make a difference. But reviewing, like you were touching to some of them, reviewing all the different things which we have been trying to implement until now. So my response is very vague. It means that I'm not very clear on what could be done to make a difference tomorrow morning. But the only things I know is not possible to sustain these all programs by having for each of two people we are putting on treatment having five new infections. It's not possible to sustain that. The second concentrated, you are so right. I fully agree with you. This morning I had a discussion with some key press leaders and one of the major issues is really make a difference already in US. What I would say, and I will continue to say with all the leaders of this city, is that you have here a concentrated epidemic, and if you don't deal with these all punitive laws, and if you don't have enabling an environment, if you don't, you will not be able to make a difference. US is a good example to start with. And I fully agree, and that's why I was talking about this all aspect of inequities, all fueling this, and we need to do that. Caribbean, and it's so real what you said. We need real evidence, public health, and it's very clear. If you take the Caribbean countries today, the countries where, and seeing you there, you know, so I'm talking by making sure that you will correct me if it's wrong, but the countries where we have a homophobic laws, where MSM are criminalized, that's where we have over 30% of MSM infected by HIV. The countries where we don't have that, we have between 0.1 to 0.1 to 2, 3 maximum infection amongst them. So it's very clear that those criminal laws, those homophobic laws are not working. It's sending people underground. It is not allowing them to have access to services. It's not helping them to get the information to make sure that they can be protected. And that is what is very... Even countries where we don't have so the criminal laws, like U.S., is difficult. 23% of infection amongst young people and 50% of them were MSM, I'm talking about, were not knowing their status. They are not having to services which could help them to imagine when you're in a situation where you don't have that one. We are making some progress. I think the debate is going on. It's not an easy one. But the issues of sodomy laws in India was a very tough one. 160 years, but I think through strong advocacy, pushing and making sure that we try to show that it is a unique opportunity for India to really come also in 21st century, not only with technology, but with social reforms. We were having more than 360 people waiting to be just imprisoned for 10 years. We have been negotiating with Senegal to release those people who have been arrested and review their law. I just came from Rwanda, where I had a very good discussion with the president, with the speaker of parliament, because they are reviewing their penal penal code. Thanks. And again, so there, it was very interesting to discuss with them and understand that. Sometimes lack of proper information, formulation, and accompanying them at the right moment. It's not just those countries. I was in Norway, and I had to address the Norway parliament because they have a law which is just criminalizing HIV transmission. So, and is amazing, but because that is very dangerous. If you have a law in Norway where people feel that they are very proactive, human right, and advanced, criminalizing HIV transmission, it means that tomorrow morning, it's Norway is possible because you have access to justice. But many of those women we are talking about tomorrow can find themselves in prison because the husband will say that you transmit the disease to my son. Yes, if it's a criminal, transmission is criminal. Is why not? It's possible. So I think we have this debate, which is important. And again, I want to say, please consider AIDS is not just a problem. AIDS is an opportunity to transform society. AIDS is an opportunity to bring debate around critical issues like trade, how we position ourselves in the future, what means really public goods debate, how are we talking about drugs on long terms, how access to that. It's also about dealing with sensitive issues. And without AIDS, I think it would have been very difficult for us to talk about those issues and trying to push and help people to not be criminalized or marginalized or rejected. Thanks.
Michelle, thank you very much. Michelle, it's a busy afternoon, so I think we're going to need to let you go. But thank you for your frankness. Thank you for, you know, the recognition that these are some very tough issues where there are no easy solutions, and we need to be honest about that. Yeah. But also, thank you for clearly your very persistent view that with the right time and attention, real progress can be made and can be sustained. I also just want to thank our terrific staff here at CSIS. All right.
Thanks so much.
Let me also thank our staff here at CSIS, Emily and Daniel and Christina, who helped organize today's event. And also thank you for coming and sharing part of the day with us. We'll look forward to seeing you back here again. Thanks very much.
I want just to say that thank you to you, Lisa. Thank you to the center for organizing that. And I count on you to really accompany us in those difficult roads, but important one. Thanks again.
Thank you. No, this is a very good question.